Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, today's guests are all playing at the top of their game, pursuing their own passions. And later in the show, we'll introduce National Geographic Explorers in Residence, Beverly and Derek Joubert, and talk about National Geographic's Big Cat Week, which is coming up starting tonight. It's a celebration of cats and premieres on TV every night this week, but we'll talk about that later. And later also, we'll discuss Ram Dass's new book, Be Love Now, The Path of the Heart. It's the third in Ram Dass's trilogy, and it's all about the power of love. And we'll be joined by Ram Dass's co-author, photographer, and writer, Ramesh Dass. But first, we're going to take an imaginary trip overseas to discuss international intrigue, global culture, and a little history with best-selling thriller writer Steve Berry. He's a worldwide success with 11 million book copies in print in 37 different languages, printed in 50 countries. Steve Berry's written about the Amber Room, the Romanovs, the Vatican, the Library of Alexandria, the burial place of Alexander the Great, and Napoleon's lost treasure. It's said that he melds truth into fiction better than anyone else, and he does that again in his new novel. It's called The Emperor's Tomb. Steve Berry, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Well, 11 million books in print, that's just phenomenal. You must be feeling pretty good about that.
I have to pinch myself sometimes because 9 years ago I couldn't give away a book. So, it's all happened for me in the last, 7-8 years, because it took me 12 years to get published. From the day I wrote my first word, the day I sold my first word, it was a long process, 85 rejections. So, I say all the time, only in America could this happen.
Yeah, and I read that you wrote 5 separate manuscripts that before you got published too. So there's a lot of work that you put into this.
Oh, yeah. It was a total of 8, actually. 5 got submitted to New York houses and got rejected 85 times. The other 3 never even got submitted. So, yeah, it was a very long process for me.
So what kept you going, Steve? Obviously, you believed in yourself. You believed in your work. What kept you going?
A little voice in your head. That's what every writer has. Every single writer on the planet has a little voice in their head that tells them to do it. It nags at you. It drives you crazy. It tells you to write. It keeps you focused. It's just that little voice. And I had that voice, but I ignored it for 10 years. Finally started listening to it. And then, now that I recognize it and know that it's there, I pay attention to it more. So that little voice would keep me focused.
Right. Now, did you have to have a real job?
Oh, yeah, I was a lawyer.
You were a lawyer?
I was a lawyer. I practiced law for 30 years. Yeah, I was a divorce lawyer, trial lawyer, criminal defense lawyer. I was a trial. That's what I did, a courtroom. And I would write in the mornings, and then I'd work all day. And then I'd research at night, and I'd write again the next morning early, before the day got going.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about this book, because you write suspense thrillers. You say you like to read thrillers. You like to write thrillers. You go international. You cover all countries and cultures, probably because you're interested in history. Is that part of it?
Yeah, it's something that interests me. I try to find something that's going to hold my attention for a year, year and a half. But more importantly, I try to find something that's going to hold the reader's attention. I'm looking for something from the past, like, Templars or the Lost Library of Alexandria, or the Lost Tomb of Alexander the Great or Charlemagne, or in this book, the Tomb of Qin Shi, China's first emperor. Something from the past you may not know a lot about, but you want to know more about it. And that's what I try to look for, those unique things.
Mm. So what was it that made you decide on China for this book?
Well, I wanted Cotton to have a different adventure. I wanted to get him out of Europe a little bit because he'd done 5 adventures in Europe, so we were trying to change it up a little bit. I'd never done a lot of work in China. I'd never read about Chinese history. It was not an area of the world that I was very familiar with, so it was a challenge for me to learn all of that. And as I got into it, I began to see, wow, this is incredible, all of the stuff that's relevant to China. And this book is going to bring a lot of that out. It deals with all the Chinese innovations that well over 50% of the world's inventions and concepts came from China.
I was just reading that right before we went live, and I was staggered to read that. It was amazing.
It's amazing what they conceived long ago, and then they went into a self self-inflicted hibernation, which basically stagnated them for centuries and centuries. It would be incredible what they would have accomplished if they had not done that. But they were way ahead of their time, that society was. And they did something 2,500 years ago that nobody else on the planet did. They drilled for oil, actually, back then. And they actually went down looking for salt brine and found oil and natural gas and learned how to harness and use that. So this book is a book about oil. It's what it deals with. It deals with oil, but it has nothing to do with the Middle East. And it's a very interesting concept relative to oil that the Chinese and the Russians together adhere to.
Yeah. I was reading through the writer's notes over the weekend, and the Russians feel very strongly that there is no oil crisis. After writing all this and doing all your research, where do you stand on that?
That's a good question. I mean, they are firmly convinced that not all oil is biotic in origin, meaning coming from dead creatures. Fossil fuels is just a theory that was created in the 19th century, and nobody knows if it's true. Nobody knows if all oil comes from dead organic material. The Russians believe that at least some of our oil comes from inorganic material from within the earth. It's produced naturally by the earth and is replenished. And if that's the case, then oil could very well be infinite in some respects, and that would change everything. And the Russians really believe this theory of abiotic oil, and they're very convinced of it. I was fascinated when I was reading about it, so I was glad I was able to weave it into a thriller so the American readers can now take a look at it and see what they think.
Yeah. Now, I said at the beginning of the show, I read several critiques that said nobody melds truth into fiction better than you do.
That's
and
right.
There's so much in this book that is true. You list all of this at the back. You identify what was true, and so much of it is true. What surprised you the most about some of the truths around China?
Well, I had no clue that they had created so many concepts and inventions and things. I didn't know that. The Chinese had a very bad habit. Every time a Chinese emperor would come into office and would take over, they would eradicate all knowledge and all existence of the ones who came before them. So the Chinese literally forgot their history. I never realized this.
Oh, wow.
But I never realized how much they had done. But it took a British naturalist in the early part of the 20th century who made it his life's work to find out about all of this and to reacquaint the Chinese with their own history. I never realized how much China is responsible for the world's technology. They were printing books long before Gutenberg was. But they get no credit for that.
Right.
We always say,
right,
who invented the printing press? Gutenberg. That's not true.
Right.
The Chinese were doing it several hundred years before Gutenberg.
Yeah.
And so it's a society that sort of took itself out of the loop and went into hibernation for a long, long time, and it cost them dearly. But they also gave us something else that the world has. It's not necessarily a good thing, but they were also created the concept of totalitarianism. It came from China, is where it was originated. And this book explores that concept of legalism in China with Confucianism. That's the fight between over there. That's the big political fight over there. You know, we have blue and red states. They have legalism and Confucianism, and it's just a good old fashioned adventure story that deals with some of these concepts and tries to get the reader a little bit interested in that part of the world. I know that I became very interested in writing the book.
Yeah, it was fascinating. And, I mean, you get a good thrill ride while you're reading it, too.
Oh, yeah. Tom Malone has quite an adventure here. I mean, he goes from Copenhagen to Belgium to Vietnam into China. It's quite a run.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that surprised me in the book, and you say that you cover this in the book because, again, you want to raise awareness, is that 70,000 kids every year go missing in China.
Yeah, that's a big deal over there. Stealing children is an industry in China. It's a national tragedy over there that has it. Particularly young boys, usually below the age of four, they don't like to get them much over four or five because they will remember their family and remember how to get back to where they came from. They try to find them where they don't really remember where to go back to. The one-child policy of China has created a real problem over there. Boys are cherished. Females, a lot of them either were aborted or killed when they were younger. It's become such a problem that there's a shortage of women in China actually now. It's a problem. But the the stealing of children and the trafficking of children over there is a big deal, and I wanted to bring some awareness to that in the story.
Yeah, I was shocked to read that it's illegal to steal a child, but it's not illegal to buy one.
No.
I mean, come on.
That's amazing. You know, no, they don't. And the Chinese government doesn't want to talk about it. They say they're trying to do something about it, but they're really not. It's
right.
not. They're not doing anything about it like needs to be done. If your child's taken over there, you're pretty much on your own. There's very little you can do about it. There was a superb HBO documentary on this that was, I've seen it several times on HBO. A British film crew went over there and did an incredible film on it that really showcased this whole problem in great detail.
Yeah, I think I've actually seen that. So tell us a little bit about, for those who've never read your books, tell us a little bit about your protagonist, Cotton Malone, and his lady friend.
Well, he's a retired Justice Department operative who lives in Copenhagen now, and he runs an old bookshop there. And every once in a while, he gets drugged back into what he used to do for a living, and it pulls him back in, either his ex-boss or his friend Henrik Trevallison, or Cassiopeia Witt, who's his a woman he met in the Templar legacy. And they had kind of a not really a very good relationship. It began to develop in the Venetian betrayal. She's been gone for the last two books. She wasn't in the Charlemagne Pursuit or the Paris Vendetta, but she's come back here, and their relationship is going to go through a change. Can't say if it's good or bad, but it is going to have a change to it in this book as they deal with this whole Emperor's Tomb and everything associated with it. Cotton's an ordinary guy. He's not a superhero. He's got an ex-wife. He's got a son. He's got some problems there. He has to work for a living. He makes mistakes. He screws up, but in the end, he rises to the occasion. So he's an ordinary fella. He's not a superhero James Bond kind of character, but he's a guy that you'd like to be in a foxhole with. He's a very loyal guy. He still stays with you. He watches your back. And, the readers have identified with him, and a lot of readers have identified with Cassiopeia. I've got a lot of email, where is she, where is she? Well, just like in real life, we don't all see all of our friends all the time, neither does Cotton, so he missed her for two books, but she's back now.
Yeah, I think that's what makes the characters so likable, so real. You feel a connection with them. Now, I've read that some people say there's always a formula to certain kinds of books, whether they're mysteries or suspense, thrillers, whatever. You say you look for the secret, what you call the secret source, which is the ooh factor. I wonder if you'd talk to us about that.
Yeah, I always try to find a book, ooh factor. The thing that if I say it, you kind of go ooh a little bit, like Templars or Alexandria or Paris or Charlemagne or Emperor. Those words kind of evoke a like, ooh, oh, that's pretty good. Ooh, it's like an ooh factor, I call it. And I try to find that because that's what gets your immediate attention. But that's not enough for one of these. You have to have the so what. Who cares if we find the lost Library of Alexandria? Who cares about the Emperor's Tomb? What does it matter if the Templars are still around? I have to link up that ooh factor with something in today's world that matters with the so what to it. And that also factors into my titles. The second word is the ooh word, and the third word is the so what word. And that's how we do it. Unless it's a noun title like The Third Secret or The Amber Room, that's just a thing. Or The Emperor's Tomb, that's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the other titles are action titles. The Alexandria Link, The Venetian Betrayal, The Templar Legacy. That third word has a meaning. And when you get into the book, you'll see exactly what that is.
Right. Now, a couple of things I want to talk about before you go today, because you've got such an interesting background and interested in so many different things. You say history is important. It matters. It's much more than tangible items. And I know you and your wife have founded an organization. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
History Matters is something we created as a way to kind of give back. We discovered that there was nothing out there anymore for historic preservation. There's no money for that anymore. So we created History Matters to help communities raise some money. And the way we do it is a very unique way. They'll have a project in the community. We'll come in, and we put on a writing seminar. And I teach writing for 5 hours. It's a pretty intense 5-hour course. You buy your way in with a contribution. Usually it's about $100 to $150, and every dime of that goes to the restoration project. I don't charge to come, and I don't charge expenses or anything like that. I pay for all that myself. We've done 6 of these around the country. We've raised a little over 40 grand. I've taught about 350 students, and we
Wow.
have 6 more coming next year. This is new. It's catching on. It's a unique way to raise money. I'll give you an example of how it really helped. I did one in a community. We raised $5,000, which I didn't think was a lot of money. I was a little, you know, embarrassed about it a little bit. And the lady said, no, you don't understand. Our local historical museum here is a 19th century building. It has a giant hole in the roof. It's destroying the building. This $5,000 is going to patch that hole and save the building till we can get to it in greater detail. So you can see just a little bit of money can go a long, long way. So
right,
we're gonna keep doing it. If anybody out there has a project, go to my website, steveberry.org, and contact us through History Matters, and we'll see if we can come out and help you.
Very good. And I know you were recently overseas with some other thriller writers. You went over on a USO tour. Talk to us a little bit about how did that change you, if at all?
It was amazing. It changed me dramatically. I'd never seen anything or done anything like that before in my life. I mean, myself, Doug Preston, David Morrell, James Rollins, and Andy Harp were the first group of thriller writers ever sent to a war zone by the USO. We Operation Thriller, we went over there. We spent 9 days. We went into Kuwait, Baghdad, Mosul, Balad, Basra. We went to Walter Reed into the Naval Hospital at Bethesda. We saw the horrifically injured there. It was an incredible nine-day experience. We talked books and writing. The reading is the number one recreational activity over there,
mm-hmm.
and they were just thrilled to have writers. We heard it over and over again. We get sports celebrities, we get actors, and we get cheerleaders. And we get everybody over here. We've never had a writer before. This is great, and they love to talk about writing and reading. And we went into the hospital and saw the injured. And it was very moving because, I mean, these are some horribly injured individuals, not a negative word among any of them. They were just upbeat, positive. So the whole experience changed me. I'd never been in a war zone. I'd never been around military at that level before. And it really gave me a huge appreciation for what these men and women do.
Right. Now, do you think you'll do something like that again?
I'd love to if they'd ask me. Unfortunately, I may not get to ask. They're going to do Operation Thriller 2. It worked so well. They're going to do it again next year. If they'd ask me, I'd go in a heartbeat, but probably some of our other writers. I'm a member of ITW, International Thriller Writers, 1,500 thriller writers from around the world. I imagine a few of our other members will get a chance the next time.
Yeah, it does sound like a life-changing experience and doing good work for helping our troops, too. Final thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Steve?
Be great if they could check out The Emperor's Tomb and see if they like it. And if they do, to check out some of my other books. I think it'd be really great. They're wonderful thrillers. They got the history, secrets, action, conspiracy, all those kind of things. I'm also going to be in the area. I'm coming there, you know, on December the 9th. I'm going to be at Third Place Books.
Yeah, we'll also mention Portland, too, because we will have listeners down in Portland.
Yeah, I'll be there on December the 8th at Powell's.
Yeah, is that December the 8th? I have the 7th down here. I just want to make sure.
I'm sorry, you're right. Yeah. I'll be there tomorrow, actually.
Yeah,
tomorrow night at Powell's at Cedar Hills Crossing. That's right.
Yeah.
And then I'll be at December 9th at Third Place Books in Seattle.
Okay, and you'll be there at 7 p.m. talk and signing. And this is a really fun book. It's really fast-paced, and I really, really enjoyed it. This is the first time I've read one of your books, Steve, and mm-hmm. I'm going to be reading some more.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Dan Brown calls it sexy, illuminating, my kind of thriller. The Huffington Post said Steve Berry gets better and better with each new book. And his new book is called The Emperor's Tomb. Steve Berry, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, National Geographic explorers Derek and Beverly Shijoubert share their 30-year journey of filming big cats in Botswana. They've made 22 films, written 10 books, and hundreds of articles, all with the goal of celebrating and conserving big cats. Tune in for Big Cats Week on National Geographic TV this week, every night at 9 p.m. And join Vicki next Monday at noon Pacific to talk with the filmmakers. See more at conversationslive.net. Intuitive dream coach Joyce Chapman says there are no little dreams, that every desire is important, and that you deserve life to its fullest. As a dream activist, Joyce has helped thousands of people gain clarity about their lives and make positive changes. She can help you too. See more information at joycechapman.com. And if you have a question for Joyce regarding your dream, email joyce@joycechapman.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
It's my China girl. I feel a wreck without my little China girl.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we have a few minutes before we bring our next guest on. I wanted to tell you about some stuff that's coming up. Particularly, I wanted to talk about National Geographic's Big Cat Week. Last week, I got to talk with two extraordinary people. Oh, my gosh. They made me question what I'm doing with my life that isn't of any good. But they are filmmakers. They're conservationists. They've been out in Botswana for the past 30 years. And they use their filmmaking to help promote conservationism and now activism. They particularly focus on big cats, which I know, Eric, you're very fond of cats, right?
Well, house cats.
Well, the National Geographic special, the National Geographic Week, you should just see these pictures in here. They're amazing. I don't know if I can do this without dropping everything.
Oh, yeah.
Look at this.
That's
mean, they're just amazing. And they cover lions. They have a program on primarily leopards. They cover bobcats. And let me just see if I can go through. Yeah, bobcats. And everything's stuck together.
So really, all the big cats in the wild, or
yeah.
Is it just the jungle cats?
Jungle cats, clouded leopard, jaguars. Yeah, I talked about that one. Or lynx.
Okay, so
yeah,
really,
so
they're
in the big, yeah, in the wild.
The big cats,
mountain lions. Yeah, they talk about mountain lions too.
Right.
But the staggering thing was that over the past 50 years, just in 50 years, lions and leopards have decreased in numbers by 95%.
95%?
They are becoming set to go extinct if we do not take action soon. And the film is the film that I watched of Beverly and Derek Joubert's work is a compilation of work that they've done over the 30 years, and National Geographic has sponsored their work. They've put them as, for the past, I think since 2006, they've been National Geographic explorers in residence out in Botswana. And so National Geographic is sponsoring this week of films about these cats, big cats, and all kinds of filmmakers from all over the world. But it just is really outstanding work. And it starts tonight at 9 p.m., on the National Geographic TV channel. And if I can find the link here, there's a link to the website.
For those of us without cable, hopefully this will be out on DVD eventually.
It will do, because I don't have this channel either, actually. I saw the DVDs. But if you go to nationalgeographic.com/bigcats or causeanuproar.com, you can find out more about the program and the cats and some of the history. Derek and Beverly Joubert, the nicest people, really grounded and down to earth, as you might imagine, doing this kind of work, living in a tent for 30 years.
You would have to be grounded to manage doing that.
Right. But they're genuinely, genuinely concerned. And I guess to wrap this little segment up, we can play a clip of the interview that I pre-recorded last week. We're going to bring you the full interview next week. But here's a clip just from Beverly and Derek Schubert.
Well, the first thing is to have... we're delighted that National Geographic are dedicating an entire week to this on Nat Geo Wild, because what it does is it focuses people's attention on this. I think that the real problem with all big cats, and lions in particular, is that we just think Africa's full of them. You know, they're so visual and they're so iconic, and we think there can't be a problem with lions, surely. Somebody should be taking care of it. Well, the truth is that we're not. We're not doing a fantastic job of this. And so National Geographic giving us this week to talk about it is fantastic, because it's about awareness. But the truth is we have to go further than that. We have to take action. And we started the Big Cats Initiative, where we are planning. We've got an action plan. This is an emergency action plan. If we don't do something about these big cats now, we will see extinctions by 2020, 10 years from now. And that's got to be all-encompassing. That's got to be buying land around the national parks, creating corridors. It's got to be compensation for cattle where lions kill cattle. We've got to step in. We've got to have a dialogue with the Maasai. There's got to be, you know, early warning for when lions are heading towards villages. We have to do basically an entire menu of things to try and stop the conflict between man and these big cats, otherwise they will be gone soon.
And this really is an emergency intervention. It's saying take action now, otherwise we will see the decline of these cats and we will move into extinction.
I can't imagine that that even people sitting in the middle of America or Europe or Australia even, who never will have a chance to go to Africa, I can't imagine that these people would be comfortable knowing that big cats disappeared from Africa.
I can't imagine that either. Could you imagine Africa without big cats?
It's so iconic. I mean, when you think of Africa, you think of lions, you think of tigers, you think of panthers and, well, maybe not panthers, but you think of jaguars. And,
right,
and
right.
When you think of the jungle, you instinctively think of the big cats. So the idea of some of them going extinct in 10 years' time.
In 10 years' time.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we really need to take drastic action. And again, this special that National Geographic is putting on, I saw the Derek and Beverly Joubert's film, and it is just stupendous, and I would highly recommend it. I learned a lot. I thought I knew a lot about big cats, and I actually learned a lot. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking about Ram Dass's new book, Be Loved Now, with Ramshi Das.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. ConversationsLive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? tune in to our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Forget their space and come check out our space on the web, 1150kknw.com, and find out about Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, laughing at Eric's choice of music here. We're going from big cats. We're going to now talk about love. We're going to talk about love because my guest says that's all there is. He is Rameshwar Das. He's a writer and photographer who met Ram Das in 1967. And he worked with him to deliver the new book, which is the third in a trilogy. It's called Be Love Now, The Path of the Heart. Rameshwar, welcome to the show.
Very nice to be with you.
Well, you have such an interesting journey. You met Ram Das, who I believe was then Dr. Alpert, way back in 1967. Tell us what was going on in your life and what took you to see Dr. Alpert.
Well, I was still in college, and I was expecting to see Dr. Alpert, and instead I got Ram Das. So, it was, you know, just one of those big surprises in my life, and it definitely changed my perspective.
So what did you go along for? I mean, what you were feeling very experimental at that part, that stage of your life, right?
Yeah, it was, you know, in college there was a huge amount of upheaval, and I was doing a lot of searching myself, I think, both for personal meaning and, you know, trying to figure out where I was going in my life at that time. I was expecting the Better Living Through Modern Chemistry exposition, and instead I got the guru from India.
Right. So how did he become the guru from India?
Well, Ram Das didn't become the guru. I mean, he's still being Ram Das in a very beautiful way. But the guru was this old man in a blanket up in the Himalayas. And I eventually went to see him myself. But as it turned out, you know, what I felt when I met Ram Das was what I felt when I met the guru, who we called Maharaji, which is a very common way of, it means great king, but it's just an honorific in India that goes from everybody. That the taxi driver may call you Maharaj.
Right.
He was such a wonderful and caring and loving being that I think he transformed many lives, certainly including mine and before that, Ram Das.
Mm. What, as a seeker yourself at that point, what were you looking for? What were you hoping to find?
Well, I wasn't planning to find a Hindu guru in India. I know that. That was a kind of a surprise. But I was really, you know, looking for meaning in my life and trying to find my own identity in some deeper way.
And you went to India and were expecting to go into culture shock, which many people experience when they go abroad to foreign culture. I go into culture shock when I go home, so, you know, which is not that different. But there is always a little culture shock when you go to different countries. But you said you felt really at home in India. Why?
I don't know why. It felt very natural. You know, everything is out on the street there. And it just felt completely organic, and I felt like I had just come home in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange in its way, but also very sweet. And I think the feeling that, you know, spirituality and religion so pervades that culture, in all of the iconography and everything you see, and you see saints on cab drivers' dashboards, and you know, images of the deities all over the street and on the fronts of trucks and things like that. It's really quite amazing.
Yeah, I had a very interesting discussion with a cab driver here in Seattle who was taking me to the airport one day, and he had a couple of deities hanging from his mirror, and I asked him about them, and it's really interesting to learn about the different gods and what they mean and represent. Ram Dass is, you talk in the book, in the introduction, about Ram Dass's parents, because here they have this son named Dr. Alpert who's working at Harvard, and he is now Ram Dass. And you say that they embraced him with love, and even though they must have been at a loss about, you know, what happened to him or why did this transformation come over him?
Well, his father was a, you know, tremendously high achiever. He was a lawyer who had been president of the New Haven Railroad in New York and, you know, was one of the founders of Brandeis University. And he was a straight-ahead guy, you know, he was really, but there was something that, you know, really flowed between him and, he always called him Richard anyway. And it was just this deep affection. And I don't think he really had much of a clue about what Ram Dass was up to in terms of teaching and where he was directing his energy. But it was Ram Dass' stepmother, his father had remarried. Mm-hmm. They were just very sweet with him. I think they just felt that depth of affection.
Right, right.
And later, Ram Dass took care of his father when he was dying, and they just got into a very deep place together.
Mm. Dr. Wayne Dyer says of Ram Dass that he introduced Wayne Dyer to the idea of higher consciousness and became one of his greatest teachers. What was the greatest lesson for you with being with Ram Dass?
Well, I think even in that initial meeting, it was kind of you know, when the perspective changes in the photograph or the figure in the ground reverse in a picture, and I suddenly went from seeing myself as the center of the universe with all of my problems and preoccupations to being kind of just another spark of light in a much wider cosmos of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, you know, it just changed my view of everything. And in India, they have a word for that. It's called darshan, and it literally means view. And you see yourself from the viewpoint of another level of consciousness.
Right. Now, I said in the beginning that this is the third book in a trilogy. Ram Dass, first of all, brought out Be Here Now, which was 40 years ago. Then came Still Here, and now this book with you, Be Loved Now. What exactly was your role in this?
Well, this was a very collaborative writing project, and we really had a good time doing it, too. I mean, we laughed a lot. I live in New York, so we worked long distance over the phone and emailing versions of it back and forth. And it's been a project that's been an evolution for a long time. And when he stopped traveling, we really took the time to get it together and just develop it into the book that it became.
Now, you started this in the 70s, I believe, if I recall correctly.
Started it, and it started out as kind of a survey of the spiritual scene in the West, and it was going to be very much a photographic book. book, and most of my work has been as a photographer more than a writer. The focus of it changed as we started to rework it, and I think it's really become kind of a recap of where Ram Dass has been since Be Here Now.
I like this. You say in the foreword, over the years, something has crystallized in Ram Dass, elements from the rainbow of his experiences in academia, psychology, psychedelics, India, and the stroke, because he had a stroke, have coalesced into a clear white light of wisdom. And working with him, you said when you waxed pedantic, he brought it back to the heart. When you were mired in ego, he subtly changed the point of view to the soul. Talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, I think especially since the stroke, he's really come into a deeper, quieter place. His narrations are slower and deeper. And I think his wisdom, maybe from the difficulties of overcoming the disabilities from the stroke, has really, you know, it has deepened his compassion, among other things.
Right, right. The book is called Be Love Now, The Path of the Heart. When we come back, Rameshwar, I want to ask you about the difference between the emotional heart and the spiritual heart. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Rameshwar Dass.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of.
This is Kim Arellano. Join me on Wednesdays at 4 o'clock for Walk the Talk with Kim. We will focus on nonprofit and community organizations to strengthen our community through knowledge, leadership, and collaboration. We will challenge our listeners to walk the talk and take action to support the health and growth of our nonprofit community. You will be inspired with stories of triumph and lessons in leadership. So put on your walking shoes, grab your brain, and let's walk the talk with Kim. Every Wednesday at 4 p.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Is love what the world needs now? Is love what the world.
And welcome back, everyone. We are talking in this segment on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair about Be Love Now, The Path of the Heart, which is written by Ram Dass with Rameshwar Dass. And Rameshwar Dass is joining us today. And I wanted to ask you, Rameshwar, about the, you say it's easy to confuse the emotional heart and the spiritual heart, because obviously they're both the heart. But talk to us about the differences, if you would, please.
Well, I think it comes to the difference between the kinds of emotional love that you experience in a relationship with another person and the deeper love that comes from the what we might call the soul, or from that's maybe what I would call that spiritual heart. That's another way of expressing that. And, you know, emotional love is always kind of transactional, and there's the give and take of relationship and wanting something from another person,
mm-hmm.
And dealing with their desires too. But the that deeper love, I think, it's almost like just feeling the sunshine on your body. You know, it's just like you feel it radiating from either from within or from another being. And it's unconditional in the sense that you don't have to do anything for it. It's all just that from being in touch with the place that we share together in our hearts, where we're all the same kind of being.
Mm. I like this in the book. It says that even when it becomes confused with our ego projections, love is actually from the higher essence of our being, the part that begins to merge with the spirit and approach the one.
Yeah, it's not a it's not a distinction. It's a continuum. Love is love. Sometimes it gets confused with our desire system, for sure. But I think it, in the sense that it's the emotion that brings us together and, takes us toward merging into oneness. It's all the same stuff.
Mm. I want to talk about some of the lessons on love that Ram Dass shares in the book. He says, love is a state of being, not a trip from here to there. Talk about that a little, if you would, please.
Well, I think we tried to use the example of some of the Indian saints that we've either met or encountered in readings or stories from other people. And those beings are like, in the same way your radio station is broadcasting, they're like the broadcasters of love. And they're just putting it out there. And it's not, there's kind of just radiating it. And it affects everyone around them. So in that sense, I think it's just the state of their being that is coming out. And in the same way, we can aspire to that.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the most important lessons that you've learned in the East?
Well, I think we have sort of this can do, try and do it attitude as Westerners a lot. And spiritual work, if you want to call it that, is not about trying to do something. It's often about letting go or trying to not try.
Right.
It's just letting things be.
Right.
And sometimes that's the hardest thing for Westerners to let go of.
Yes,
I would agree. One of the elder devotees around my guru about giving up attachments. And he said, well, you can give them up or you can wait until they give you up. And it was just in that sense of it's all just happening. And you need to let it be.
Let it be. Yeah, another great song from the 60s or 70s, whatever.
Thank you to the Beatles for that.
Yeah, thank you to the Beatles. you talk a lot about pleasure, happiness, and joy, and say that there's a difference. Happiness is still worldly, you say, but has a benign attribute that brings with it a flood of positive emotion. Well, how do you describe joy?
Well, I think joy is more akin to the bliss of feeling that oneness, where it's less of a personal experience and just the flood of that love coming through.
So it's more spiritual?
Well, in the sense that it's not, an interpersonal emotion.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, you write that pleasure is something that comes through the senses, so there's a very clear difference there.
Well, I think so. I mean, when you experience pleasure, there's usually some other side of it that eventually turns into discontent or dissatisfaction or discomfort when it ends, at least.
Right.
Which it usually does.
Right. Okay. That's not an answer I expected from you. What about surrendering to love? You write in the book, in the West, surrender implies, we do think, I never used to like the word surrender because to me it meant I was giving up. And in the West, it has the connotation that we're actually giving up power. But you say, no, that's not at all true. When you surrender to a guru or the beloved, it doesn't mean up giving power to another human being. It's letting go of the stuff that keeps you separate. I wonder if you talk about that for a little.
Well, I guess it goes back to this idea of guru, which is, you know, really a tough one in the West because we have so many, you know, weird ideas about fashion gurus and sex gurus and every kind of guru
right.
under the sun. And
right.
the real guru is inside. So when you're surrendering to a guru, even if it's an external being, it's because it's a reflection of that deepest place inside you that they're mirroring for you. So that surrender is really the letting go into your deeper self. And you don't really have to worry about losing power in that kind of situation. When it is that, I mean, you know, there are and have been in the West lots of people representing themselves as gurus who aren't really the one who can take away our ignorance, if you want to say it that way. I mean, the illusion of separateness, I think, is maybe the better way to talk about it. A guru is someone who can take away that illusion and help you get to that place of oneness.
Mm. One of the other lessons in the book, which is powerful, is value your beloved above yourself. Talk about that a little, if you would.
Well, I think that's in the context of this path of the heart, of devotion. Of opening yourself to love, and when you, if you think of the that place inside you as another being or another state of being, surrendering yourself to it is kind of placing all of your highest values in that place or that being. So, you know, it's like. You know, a mother and their infant, you know, where your highest desire is to have the best for that being,
right.
for that beloved being that's in your care. And that's one of the, for instance, the what they call the bhavs or the moods of the devotional path. You think of God as your child. And you use that as a way to open your heart to that place.
Interesting. As I think so often now we're told that if we really put somebody else's love and care before ourselves, we're codependent. We like to
yeah.
label everything, you know.
Yes. Well, you know, again, that's going back into the relationship side of,
right.
of love.
Right.
And... codependency or, you know, losing yourself and somebody else and, you know, surrendering your being. Those are all, that's confusion, I think, over a different way of relating.
Mm. At this stage in your journey at Rameshwar, do you see yourself as a student or a teacher?
Oh, I'm definitely in the, I'm on the path, mode. I'm a householder. I have two kids who are sometimes my greatest teachers. And, you know, I'm probably many, many lifetimes away from that unitary state. But then again, it's just a thought,
mm-hmm.
you know.
You don't
but I don't see myself as a teacher. I see myself more as a student.
Mm. Well, lots of great lessons in this book. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think beginning to feel that deeper love can take us all into a place where we see less division and more sameness between human beings, and perhaps that can lessen some of the conflicts that we all see around us all the time.
Well, thank you. I thank you for being with us and sharing your journey with us. The book is called Be Loved Now, The Path of the Heart. It's by Ram Dass with Ramshwar Dass. And I understand the electronic version of Be Here Now has come out.
Yeah, there's an iPad version with videos and audio.
That's really great. And it coincides with this, with the Be Loved Now. Now, I know you're in Portland very quickly. Are you actually talking in Portland or you're just traveling today?
Tomorrow I'm coming up to Seattle and we're doing an event at the East West Bookstore.
Okay, so that's tomorrow, Tuesday. Do you know what time?
I think it's at 7 o'clock.
Okay, at the East West Bookstore. Thank you.
But check, because I haven't looked at my...
Oh. Okay, you surrendered to that. All right.
It is at 7. I'm checking.
Okay, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for being with me, Vicky.
I want to thank each of you for joining us today, and we'll be back next week at noon Pacific. Don't forget to tune in tonight, 9 o'clock, if you've got National Geographic TV. Fantastic Big Cat Week coming up all week long. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong.